In a chemical world, and I'm a chemical nondescript person. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Chemical World here on KDNK. I am your co-host, Kenna Crampton, membership director here at KDNK.
And I am your other co-host, Maggie Saldine, peer recovery coach with MindSprings Health.
So this week we are going to talk about some laws that are in the process of hopefully getting passed.
Yeah, you know, there have been some different laws coming up this past fall, and a lot of them relate to drug decriminalization. And so I thought it would be nice to take this opportunity to kind of address, like, what are these laws actually trying to do? Because I think there can sometimes be a lot of confusion when we hear words like decriminalization versus legalization. And obviously here in Colorado, we've had recreational marijuana, but clearly that is not the case throughout the country. And so, yeah, just wanted to kind of address some of the kind of exciting stuff going on legally. So the MORE Act is the Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act. And that was passed by the House of Representatives on December 4th of 2020. So that's a huge step forward in mitigating some of the serious harm caused by the drug war. And so this act is seeking to do quite a bit of things. So on a base level, it is generally trying to federally decriminalize marijuana. But there's a lot more that goes into this. And one component of the act that I found really interesting is that it's seeking to change usage of the word marijuana to cannabis. And of course, we live in a day and age where we're really shifting how we talk about things. And that's important because language is very powerful, and language has been a huge tool in oppressing minority populations historically. And so I am really excited about that change. And I've been trying to use it in my own life because marijuana was really the term that got linked with cannabis when there was all this work happening in the 20th century to connect it to Hispanic immigrants and to make it seem like Hispanic people were coming here and bringing marijuana, and very similar to the way that cocaine and African American communities has been treated, and opium with Asian immigrants as well, just another kind of way to oppress these minority populations. I did read in one of my favorite textbooks that the laws in America are actually only specifically banning sativa plants. And so it was like these arguments that you actually don't really know necessarily what the plant is. And if it's an indica, you're not breaking any laws, but, you know, just some weird wishy-washy stuff with that.
And then it's cool that the just taking cannabis, I wanted to say marijuana. And it's funny because I, with this show, I've been trying to not say pot so much. So I'm like, oh, marijuana. And now I'm like, oh, okay, cannabis. Just go with what the right word is. That it would be taking cannabis off the scheduling system, which I think is really, really cool.
Yeah, and I think it's really important because part of being in that Schedule I system is it really restricts the ability to study the drug. And marijuana is such, cannabis is such an interesting one because you can really find science on either side. I recently attended a webinar where they were saying that there's no medical benefits of cannabis, whereas we've kind of been inundated with this idea that there's a lot of medical benefits for it. And my question is just like, where are these studies being conducted? Because NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, is really one of the only organizations in the U.S. that's permitted to study it. And there was an interesting documentary about how they hadn't even been using their cultivation fields for growing it. And so, yeah, getting it off of that Schedule I would be huge. And also, as we've talked about before on the show, Schedule I is reserved for the most dangerous drugs with the highest potential for addiction and abuse, the highest potential for harm. And there's no reason that marijuana or even LSD or peyote should be up in that Schedule I, above methamphetamine, above cocaine. It just doesn't make any sense.
And it also, I mean, and not to mention that it makes it difficult for people to study cannabis, but then it also makes it difficult for people who are creating CBD products to be able to produce and sell their products because of the fact that cannabis is on the Schedule One narcotics. So
absolutely. And I think we've been hearing stories about that for a long time. I always think of, you know, epileptic children having to travel so many states or, you know, thousands of miles just to get CBD treatment, which is very effective. And, you know, it just, yeah, creates a lot of unnecessary problems. So the MORE Act, you know, it's seeking to, yeah, get cannabis off of that Schedule One, seeking to decriminalize it. And I'll talk a little bit more today about what decriminalization really means, because I think that there is some confusion there. But basically, yeah, getting it off of Schedule One so we can study it, making it federally legal, which is a huge deal because it's really difficult for people who are in the legal system in states where recreational cannabis is legal, and yet now they have to take UAs for their job or for court or whatever that's federally mandated, and they're getting in trouble for something that they can literally buy at the corner store for less than a pack of cigarettes now, is something a client said to me this morning, which is so true.
Yeah.
And so another component of this act, though, is that they're seeking to expunge criminal convictions related to cannabis. There are huge racial disparities in cannabis incarcerations. You know, it's majority Hispanic populations and African American populations historically are getting longer sentences for, you know, charges associated with cannabis than Caucasians are. And there are just a lot of people sitting in prison for cannabis, and there's no need for that. And so in addition to preventing future arrests related to cannabis and, you know, all the economic costs associated with imprisoning people for nonviolent offenses, they're also seeking to expunge people who are currently incarcerated for said offenses.
And I think it's clear when you live in a place like Colorado that the people who are using cannabis are not only people of color.
Absolutely.
So it doesn't make sense that the people who are being punished are people of color. So it's really cool stuff. And then a lot of that hinges on what happens today when we're recording this episode, which is the 5th of January, but it's going to be airing on the 11th. And what's going to be happening today, Maggie?
Yeah, so today...
On January 5th.
So today, as of our recording, this afternoon or this evening is the Georgia Senate runoff elections. So there are two Senate seats in Georgia being re-voted on today because no candidates received 50% of the vote in November. And it's very exciting, and it's also very nerve-wracking. And you people listening to this on January 11th know a lot more than I do at this point. But basically, these Senate seats are going to determine the party control of the Senate House. And so they need if one of the two goes Republican, the Republicans control the Senate, and it'll be very unlikely that this act will be able to move past the Republican-controlled Senate. And of course, those Senate seats, however they end up, are really going to determine a lot of the future momentum of the country. But, you know, regardless of where this act gets in the Senate, the fact that it passed the House of Representatives is a huge win. I mean, you know, it takes literal decades, you know, to get this stuff going. And so just the fact that it exists and passed anything is still a huge win, and it can give us some optimism that we will see federal cannabis decriminalization in our lifetimes.
Yeah, very cool. And, you know, of course, who knows what will happen even if Republicans have control over the House. You know, they may, you know, we'll just see what happens. But it's on its way. And the fact, like you said, that it passed one of the hurdles that it's facing, you know, we're going to keep fighting. You know, the people who got this act together are going to keep fighting no matter what happens. So
absolutely. And it's really interesting if you research it a little bit, just how different organizations, you know, stand on cannabis use for medical purposes. But I think at the end of the day, the point is we won't know until we can get it off of that Schedule One and get it really thoroughly studied.
Yeah. So what we're hoping for cannabis is federal legalization. But one thing when it comes to harder drugs that we have talked more about is decriminalization, which is what they've done in Oregon in that last election, which I think is really exciting that there's even one state out of in this country that's even trying it, because I think it's so successful. I think it will show the rest of the country how successful it can be. But it's really confusing, the difference mm-hmm. between legalization and decriminalization. So tell us more about that, Maggie.
Yeah, you know, I've been getting a lot of calls recently talking about, oh, Oregon just legalized all drugs and, you know, things of that nature because of, yeah, the law that they did pass in November. But I did want to kind of clarify, you know, the differences between legalization and decriminalization. And so with marijuana, they are, you know, seeking to decriminalize, but it gets a little confusing with recreational sales for sure, where that is basically it's legalized, right? So I just wanted to address, like, what is it that actually happened in Oregon and what is happening there? What are these new laws? While Oregon has long since been a front runner in more compassionate drug laws, this measure is especially poignant to the people of Oregon, as one in 11 residents is reportedly addicted to drugs, and on average, two people die every day in the state from overdose.
Wow, those are some shocking statistics.
And so I think we all are at least vaguely familiar with the fact that places like Portland and Seattle definitely have more extreme drug problems than other areas of the country. But still, this is really the direction that a lot of our country is heading if we don't start using more evidence-based practices and compassionate care towards our populations who use substances, whether it's alcohol or illicit substances or cannabis. You know, this is a law that was really advocated for by police departments because, you know, it really takes a lot of time and money to be writing these misdemeanor charges over and over and over again, often to the same folks.
Yeah, and I just want to just real quick butt in and just say that that's one reason why decriminalization is so important, is because what, and we've said this before on this show, that addiction is a human rights problem and it's not a criminal problem. And the fact that we're treating these addicts who are on the streets like they're criminals when they're not, they're really just lost.
Right. And, you know, in my work, my stance is we need to stabilize other aspects of people's lives before we can even focus on the recovery piece. If you do not have safe housing, we can't focus on recovery today. We have to focus on your safe housing. If you need a job and have don't have financial stability, we need to focus on that, right? And in my mind, it's like if you can have all those other, you know, quadrants of wellness in your life addressed, and if you can have all that, you probably really won't have that need for seeking out substances to cope. Yeah, you know, the majority of drug offenders, these aren't violent crimes. And, you know, when they do become crimes that affect other people, it's usually, you know, burglaries, robberies, things like that, where they're stealing to get the money for their fix. But, you know, is it really the best use of all of our time and effort to be just punishing these nonviolent offenders? Is that really what's keeping our community safe? So, moving on, specifically talking about Oregon. So, the new drug decriminalization laws in Oregon will take effect on February 1st of 2021, and the measure passed in November decriminalizes possession of small amounts of all drugs and reduces penalties for possession of larger amounts and redirects cannabis tax revenue towards services and programs that address drug addiction. And so, again, I'll talk about this a lot today. So when we talk about decriminalization, that doesn't mean like it is just a free-for-all. So to clarify, under this new law, the possession of the following amounts would result in a non-criminal violation similar to a traffic ticket. So less than 1 gram of heroin, less than 1 gram or less than 5 pills of MDMA, less than 2 grams of meth, less than 40 units of LSD, which I think is quite a few, less than 12 grams of psilocybin, less than 40 units of methadone, less than 40 pills of oxycodone, and less than 2 grams of cocaine. So basically, these are described as personal use amounts. It is assumed that you are not trying to sell it if this is the amount that you have. These are just for your private use. And so again, it's not completely legal. You would still get a citation, but you're not going to get a felony or even a misdemeanor violation like you would in the past. And in places like Seattle, they have these amazing first responder programs where police officers can determine if this person should have a social service reference, if they should be referred to the recovery and treatment options. And we have more co-response happening here in the Valley as well, for sure. I think that's just kind of a general theme, is that, yeah, the police are not mental health crisis practitioners. That is not what they're here for. They have a lot on their plate already, and a lot, I mean, gosh, talk about one of the most stressful jobs. You know, going out there every day protecting your community. So it really is about, you know, connecting people with the treatments and services they need and not punishing them. And so, again, rather than facing criminal charges, citations for the personal amounts are in Oregon are either like a $100 fine or attendance in new addiction recovery centers that are going to be funded by this cannabis revenue. And then the measure also reduces the possession of the following amounts from a felony to a misdemeanor. So 1 to 3 grams of heroin, 1 to 4 grams of MDMA, 2 to 8 grams of meth, and 2 to 8 grams of cocaine. So while all drugs aren't legal in Oregon, the new measure reduces the charges associated with possession of these drugs in these amounts, which are generally considered to be personal use. It's still illegal to possess any illicit substances, but with fewer legal consequences. And drug trafficking charges remain largely unaffected. If you've got more than 4 grams of heroin, you're probably going to be seeing some time for sure. But this is really a groundbreaking step in this general theme that we're seeing in the nation today. Like you said, that drug use, it's a public health issue, it's a personal rights issue, not a criminal justice issue, and that our traditional punitive methods of controlling and criminalizing drug users have shown to be largely ineffective at reducing the serious harm of drugs, including death, lost productivity, and gang violence.
And I also want to just point out that even if this were to be a legalization of all drugs, legalization of drugs does not mean a free-for-all of drugs either. And it would be the federal government controlling the amount of drugs that people are buying at a time, which, you know, I mean, they say that that's what's happening right now. But one thing that I just, from that book, Chasing the Scream by Johan Hari, he mentions that the way that we have it set up now is that we are legally giving opiates to people until they become addicted. Mm-hmm. And then the moment they're addicted, we stop giving it to them, to the point then. So then they have to go seek it on the streets and from other criminals, and possibly getting fentanyl or other drugs laced in their drugs. And so I just, because I think that when people think of legalization, they do think of it as a free-for-all. And that is not what would happen, even if it was legalization, which is not what is happening in Oregon right now. So I hope I'm not making it more confusing. But
no, and I think that that's a great point. And I think we'll talk about it a bit more later as I use a couple more international case studies to really describe this difference that, yeah, alcohol is legal. It's regulated by the government, right? Marijuana is legal. To a degree, it is regulated by the government. It would still technically be illegal to sell cannabis on the black market, right? And
exactly.
And another, you know, point that Johan Hari makes in that book is that when alcohol prohibition ended, all the gang violence related to alcohol running ended. And so really keeping these substances illegal is what creates a lot of the violence, a lot of the crime.
And then, sorry, one more story that Johan Hari uses is an undercover cop who was on a job, and a kid came up to him and asked him to go into the store and buy him some liquor. And the guy said no. He was, you know, a young boy, you know, maybe 12 years old. And then he realized that the boy could go to any of the drug dealers that were hanging out outside of the liquor store and buy the drugs. If he wanted, like the drugs mm-hmm. were way easier for this 12-year-old kid to get his hands on than the alcohol was. So another thing to keep in mind.
So I wanted to talk about, so while we're on the topic of decriminalization, I wanted to use the example of Portugal, of what real, true national drug decriminalization would look like. So in 2001, little background for you, Portugal became a front runner in national drug policy, receiving scrutiny from the UN for their choice to nationally decriminalize all drugs. similar to the new policies in Oregon, drugs are not completely legal, but criminal penalties are reduced and access to recovery treatment is increased. When a police officer comes into contact with people using or possessing drugs, they confiscate the substances and refer them to a dissuasion commission, which operates independently of the criminal justice system and is comprised of one legal official and two health or social service representatives. These commissions make decisions on a case-by-case basis and can impose fines, group therapy, or other recovery treatments. So again, very similar. You're either getting fined and or you're being referred to treatment for your substance use issues. And treatment is always voluntary. It's never ordered by the group. Sanctions can be applied if someone declines to enter treatment, but this rarely occurs. If someone's drug use is deemed to be non-problematic by the commission and they're not cited for any more drug charges in the next 6 months, their case is completely dropped. Again, another little tidbit from Johan Hari, and I hear this a lot, but a huge percentage of people who use illicit drugs do so without problem, and they are responsible. So if someone is cited for carrying more than a personal use amount in Portugal, they might still be referred to the dissuasion committee or cited for drug trafficking. And again, trafficking in Portugal can incur a sentence of 1 to 12 years in prison, depending on the type of drug, amount, cooperation with law enforcement, and reason for selling the drugs. So we're not concerned about personal use. If someone is using for personal reasons, that is a totally different situation. But if they're trafficking drugs or selling drugs in a decriminalized environment, that is still against the law and it still comes with heavy penalties. Just like I was saying, you still can't technically sell black market cannabis in our current decriminalized structure.
We're making responsible the people who are actually committing crimes and hurting the communities. We're keeping those people responsible. And the people who are just everyday normal people who use illicit drugs every once in a while for, you know, New Year's or whatever it is that's going on, they're not getting in trouble, which, you know, or and even the people that are maybe using it more and have a problem, but they're not we're not holding them responsible for issues that aren't their problem.
Yeah, and you know, I feel like maybe some of you are familiar with the term functioning addict. And I think some people have personal experiences with that, whereas some people think it's a little more unbelievable. But I think I'll finish up with Portugal and kind of come back to this as I kind of touch on Switzerland a little bit. But I mean, I have known people who use heroin every single day and they do it responsibly. I know it sounds crazy, but not everyone has an addict mind. Not everybody has the trauma that leads to the real problematic use. And some people, whether it's, you know, yeah, meth on the weekends or opiates every day. I'm not advocating for this, but some people are able to do that and not have problems. So I wanted to talk about Portugal because obviously they're one of the strongest examples for national drug decriminalization. And, you know, it really has made a big difference. In the 1990s, Portugal had one of the highest rates of overdose deaths, problematic drug use, and HIV cases in the European Union. And in 1999, Portugal had the highest rate of drug-related HIV and the second highest prevalence of HIV among people who inject drugs in the European Union. And so in response to these concerns, a committee of professionals came together and determined that drugs and drug use are not inherently evil, that a drug-free society is unattainable. I think that that's key. We will never have a drug-free society. Caffeine is a drug. Nicotine is a drug. It's never going to happen. We use drugs for good reason all the time, right? Drugs have a place in this world, but it's when we're abusing them that it becomes a problem. And that people do use drugs for a number of reasons, and punitive policies, or, you know, really just punishing people for drug use is unethical and ineffective. So based on these recommendations, Portugal passed these drug decriminalization laws, and Portugal's overdose death rate decreased by over 80%. The prevalence rate of people who use drugs that account for new HIV diagnoses fell from 52% to 6%. And incarceration for drug offenses decreased by over 40%. In 1999, Portugal had 369 overdose deaths. In 2015, they had 54, which was the highest number of overdose deaths in Portugal from 2008 to 2017. And I could read to you every exact year and how many overdose deaths they had, but the point is, it went from almost 400 to less than to about 50 or less every year in the modern decade.
And so last year alone, the United States had 81,000 drug overdose deaths, compared to Portugal, who had at their highest 369. Of course, that just shows how much smaller Portugal is than the United States, but it is out of control. I mean, and you talk to anybody who knows anybody who has a problem with addiction, and they'll tell you, I mean, it's just out of control. And especially right now with, you know, the isolation that everyone's feeling, I'm getting emotional because of it. We need to do something. And like we've said before, like what we've been doing for the past 100 years is clearly not working, because it just continues to get worse. So we need to try something new. And it's so hopeful to see Oregon taking this step, because if we've seen one thing with Colorado and Oregon and Washington, and now so many, I mean, half the country has legalized cannabis because of what has happened in Colorado and Washington. And they can see that, you know, when COVID happened, we were sitting better than a lot of other states. And a lot of that had to do with the extra income that we've had from having legalized cannabis. And so I'm just saying that, you know, the country can look to Oregon to see the effects of this decriminalization. And I'm excited to see what happens.
Yeah, and especially in places like Portland and you know, states like Oregon, where they're losing 2 people a day, you know, it will be really interesting to see the impact that this has. And yeah, I know when I was living in New Mexico, you know, there was rumors that, and they had a really astringent Republican governor there for a while, and I'm not 100% sure what's going on with New Mexican politics anymore, but I heard, you know, rumors like they wanted to legalize marijuana just for that income. Is it really a huge deal to have legalized cannabis for the amount of money it's bringing in, you know? And when we're wasting so much money on these punitive methods that aren't doing anything. And I think it's just a great time to be alive, because I think a lot of people are really coming around to that realization that what we're doing is not working and that we need to change. And then this is kind of off subject, but the conversations about overdose death rates reminds me of, you know, last year when I first started doing this work really in depth, people would ask me a lot about how many overdoses happen. But it was very clear that, you know, there's this kind of differentiation in that question. Are you asking about overdose deaths, or are you asking about overdoses? Because I could not tell you how many overdoses are happening. And it's, you know, very rare that they're getting, they're not all getting reported. There's just no way. But I did find a article that was really interesting. Granted, it was from 2003. So at the very, very beginning of the current opioid epidemic, stating that about 4% of opioid overdoses end in death. And we definitely assume that number is much higher in the really, you know, fentanyl-fueled overdose deaths that we're seeing in recent years. But I just thought that was, you know, very interesting that we can still say it's safe to assume a very small amount of overdoses are actually ending in death. And every overdose increases somebody's chance for dying from an overdose. And so it's definitely a huge problem that's even bigger than we're even really aware of. Moving on, there's a lot of hope at the same time. And so, you know, Portugal has had a lot of success over the past 20 years with their decriminalization. And I just wanted to briefly mention, and Johan Hari goes really in depth into this in his book, Chasing the Scream. But in Switzerland, that's where they have really what we would think of as legalized opiates, because people are able to go in to their doctor and get heroin. And there are these clinics where people come maybe once, maybe a couple of times a day, and they are super, super successful, that these people are able to live normal lives. Like you were saying, here in America, people are given the opiate until they're addicted, and then they're cut off, and then they have to fend for themselves. And that is a really difficult situation to put somebody in, whereas if they could just go to their doctor and get this chemical that is very safe when we prepare people, when we give the right amount. And at this point, it is safer to get an opiate from a doctor than on the street, because you don't know what's in the opiate on the street, whether it's powder or pills or whatever. And so we can protect a lot of people keep a lot of people alive and also allow people to live their lives because they can still function. They can be these, that kind of quote unquote functioning addict. And Switzerland is just very interesting because it is a very conservative country. It's a small country with a lot of money. But they have been able, they basically ran on a platform that these policies protect everyone because they protect our police officers from getting, you know, needle stick injuries or having to deal with these drug offenders in the line of duty. They protect our communities by keeping our parks clean and free from trash and needles and things like that. And so really on that platform of that this is to protect everyone and to support everyone's health and safety, they were able to pass this legislation in Switzerland, and now they have legal medical heroin. And so that's what it would look like if it's legal, is you can go to your doctor and get it. And so here in America, it's so funky, right? Because you could go to your doctor and get a Schedule One drug, but if you just had that drug on you, it would be illegal. And so it gets, it's very, very gray here in America. And I think it's just getting grayer and grayer as we realize that like whatever we're doing is has not been really working very well.
Well, and it's taken pain into a different type of consideration. So right now in the United States, we see back pain as a real pain, which it is very much so. We see diabetes as a real disease because it is so. And but we have that disconnect when it comes to the pain of trauma, the pain of life for a lot of people. And we don't have that, and we have that similar disconnect when it comes to the disease of addiction. We can't see addiction as a disease that is, one, inherited by our parents sometimes, and also a disease that you cannot control without help.
Absolutely.
And so I just think that's one thing about legalizing opiates and prescribing them for pain that is just as real as back pain. It's just is not treated that way here in our country. And we're not used to seeing pain in our, you know, mental health as a something that needs to be addressed by professionals.
Yeah, and that's, I think, been so hard for the medical community is they're trying to address pain, but pain is so subjective, you know, it's so different from person to person. But I will just kind of add this caveat. What it's not, it's just what this conversation is making me think of, and something that I've been working on a lot with patients is that whether it's emotional or physical, most opiate addicts are, you know, using that substance, and honestly, or alcohol or meth or cannabis or benzodiazepines, whatever it is, right? We're using it to mask that pain, but it's not fixing the root cause of that pain. And that's the same for trauma as it is for serious chronic back pain. Opiates are not a magic bullet, and there is no magic bullet. And, you know, you have chronic back pain that you've had for 30 years, and the opiates are the only thing that make it better. But in reality, yoga, acupuncture, swimming, physical therapy, and it takes a long time. And I think that's what's really hard, especially in our culture of instant gratification, is we want something that's going to fix it now. And I don't know if any of you out there have ever been to the doctor before, but that's very, unless you have like an infection that they're just, here's antibiotics, it's almost never you leave with your problem solved that day, you know.
Yeah. And in these places in Switzerland that are prescribing heroin to treat this emotional pain, they also offer talk therapy, and they also offer a ton of education on how to use safely and properly. And if you are looking to stop using, they have a ton of resources for that as well. And like you said, you can't start getting clean until things in your life are getting better. And so this is giving people a way to use in a safe way to where they can start changing their life for the better, so that way they can begin to start healing and maybe stop using.
Absolutely. And that's kind of like how Johan Hari talks about this concept of natural recovery, that as we become adults and become more in control of our environments that a lot of people just naturally stop using substances. But for people with that really deep trauma, it's not going to be that easy. And I will also say to your point that, you know, there's just not a lot of continuity or accountability in the American medical system because, so for example, antidepressant SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, how do I remember all these things? These kind of antidepressants have been clinically proven to be ineffective by themselves. If you are just taking an SSRI antidepressant, and I hate to say that because I have a lot of close friends and family who take them and are very happy with them, but really the science shows that they're not doing anything. It's in conjunction with counseling that they're effective. And I think that that should be the same for any medication, that the medication alone is, there's no magic bullet, you know, it's going to take work. And that's definitely something we need with opioids, is at least counseling on the dangers and on how to, you know, there needs to be more. And there is, it's changing. That's all changing. But I think just historically, there is not a lot of accountability to really following that. And I just see that a lot, that prescribers might say, well, you need to be in counseling, but are they really following up with that?
And it's the same with any kind of, you know, condition. I mean, if we're talking about a heart condition, it's like you can take the medication for your heart and that's going to help, but you still have to eat right and get the right amount of exercise. I mean, or diabetes, all of these things. Yes, there's medication to help, but ask any doctor, they need to be assisted with other healthy activities.
And I also just want to add, I never recommend, you know, that people do things that I wouldn't be willing to try myself. I live with chronic pain, among many other things, and I do yoga literally almost every day to cope with that chronic pain. And no, it's not easy. And yes, it's a lot of time that I spend. I actually did an interview with the CDC, and they asked me, how much time do I spend dealing with my pain? And I'm like, 24/7, because I have to eat right. I have to drink enough water. I have to do yoga. I have to adjust myself when I'm sitting for long periods of time. You know, it's like all these things I do to mitigate my chronic pain. It's not just a pill I can take. And the pill never helped. This helps much more. So I want to just bring us to our final case study today. So I threw this one in here as kind of a contrast because, A, it's actually pretty, I guess I'll say, interesting what's happening in the Philippines. But I also thought it would be, you know, good to kind of bring a balanced perspective to this conversation. If, you know, maybe you don't like the sound of what's going on in Oregon and Portugal, let me give you this alternative and see how you feel about what's happening in a nation that's taking a very, very, very different approach to drug policy and drug crime. So, in stark contrast to the compassionate policies of countries like Portugal and Switzerland, the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, was elected in 2016 basically on a platform of killing all drug users. While estimates vary, at least 8,000 people have been extrajudicially killed in the Philippines since he took office. The Philippine government admits to upwards of 6,000 killings, while the UN and Philippine Commission on Human Rights suggest that the number is more than 27,000. In a recorded address, Duterte made a specific promise to drug users and sellers in his country. Quote unquote, "I will kill you." Duterte's actions are considered genocide by many across the world, but it is unlikely that he or the Philippine police force will be held accountable for disseminating propaganda and committing these killings comparable to the Holocaust, comparable to some really terrible things that happen all over the world, unfortunately, all the time. But I mean, this is how some countries are choosing to deal with drug policy, is to just kill the people who are using drugs. Whether you realize it or not, I am sure that you know and care about somebody who uses a drug, whether it's caffeine, whether it's Advil. I mean, obviously, I don't think Duterte is trying to kill people who use Advil, but you get what I'm saying here. Yeah. Is this really what we think the solution is to kill people who use drugs? And, you know, here in America in harm reduction, we often say we can't save them if they're not alive. We can't help them if they're not alive. All we want to do is keep these people alive because we know that recovery is possible. And it might take a long time and it might take a lot of tries, but everyone deserves basic human rights, respect, the right to live, and the right to pursue a lifestyle of their choosing if they're not hurting anyone else. yeah, I hope that you guys, you know, have found this conversation interesting, that you have had some questions answered. And of course, you can always reach out to me if you're interested to learn more about this. And don't forget to check out Chemical World on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
And the next episode of Chemical World will be airing on KDNK at 4:30 on February 8th. And the extended conversation of this episode is available on kdnk.org or at Apple Podcast or Google Podcast.
And so I'll just make my final little plugs here. Again, my name is Maggie Saldine, and I'm a peer recovery coach for MindSprings Health. If you have any questions about any of the topics we discuss on this show or are interested in support, you can reach out to me at 970-531-5060. And our MindSprings office in Glenwood is open, and we are taking virtual and in-person clients, so you can always pop in there. If you need a little extra help or just someone to talk to, please call our mental health support line at 1-877-519-7505. And if you're in a crisis, you can call our crisis line at 1-844-493-8255. And I just wanted to make two other quick plugs. Every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, I host an all recovery support group open to anyone interested in recovery. This is non-denominational. You don't have to be sober to attend. But if you're interested in a recovery group that is not affiliated with the 12-step programs, I would love if you could join me in the Zoom room. And you can find that meeting ID on KDNK's community calendar, the Post Independence community calendar as well. Finally, I just wanted to say we are really, really excited that the Front Range Clinic is now serving the Rifle and Glenwood areas from 10 to 4 on Tuesdays. Their mobile unit will be at the Mountain Family Health Center parking lot in Glenwood. And from 10 to 4 on Wednesdays, they are behind the Human Services building in Rifle over there behind the fairgrounds. And this is an amazing opportunity here in our valley. This is a mobile walk-in clinic for medication-assisted treatment for opioid or alcohol use disorder. If you have any questions about that, you can always call me, or you can call the Front Range Clinic for information and appointments at 1-866-628-7828.
And remember, you don't have to be sober
to keep your community clean.
Drugs may come and drugs may go, and that's all right, you see. Experience has made me rich, and now I can use safely. It might be beer, it might be dope, it may even be caffeine. But we all have a little something that keeps us on our feet. What's important is being safe and stopping the spread of disease. You do not have to be sober to keep your community clean. 'Cause we are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical gender nondescript. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl. You know we are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl.